the discussion question is, how do you, based on the Bohr model with a nucleus and electron orbitals, how do you produce emission and absorption lines that are visible in a spectrum? Since we started the recording late, sorry to whoever's listening to this later. So you have electron, so if we're imagining a hydrogen atom, right, you have one electron to deal with, right? You're not going to have, well, you could have more, but let's not go there. So you have an electron in your atom, and it can live in any single one of these excitation states at a given time, right? It can't be in more than one, because you can't be in more than one place at the same time, right? So why could an electron do it? it's not that simple, right? Quantum mechanics and stuff, but Bohr did the, you know, anyway. This is meant to be a simple model. So each one of these excitation states has a different energy associated with it. And as you move between different excitation states, the electron is changing its energy level, basically, right? So if you move from n equals 2, that is a real thick line. If you move from n equals 2 down to n equals 1, would you have more energy or less? So what does that mean? What would happen?
Garrett? The energy that you lost has to go somewhere, so it gets fired off as a photon.
Right. So when you drop down from n equals 2 to n equals 1, you have less energy than you had before. But what do you do with that extra energy? It has to go somewhere, and so it gets emitted as a photon. So I'll draw a photon as a little squiggle with an arrow on it, because that's the extent of my art capability. What will the energy of that photon be? Sophia.
Will be the difference between the energy that the electron has in those two different levels, because there's no in between. It has to just be a multiple of one of those differences.
So yeah, it will be the difference between those two energy levels, right? So, for the hydrogen atom, The energy of a particular, call it orbital state, I guess, just for lack of a better term here. The energy of a particular orbital state, n, is equal to negative 13.6 electron volts, which is a unit of energy. Sorry to use that one, but it gives us nice human scale numbers in this case. Divided by n squared. And then the negative sign is just because we'll define n equals infinity to be zero, basically. So to go from n equals infinity down to n equals one, that would have a difference of 13.6 eV. So if you transition between n equals one and n equals two, right? N equals 1 would have negative 13.6 eV. N equals 2 would have negative 13.6 divided by 4 eV, whatever that is. I'm not going to do the math in my head, but. So to find the energy of your photon, you take the difference of those two energies, right? So delta E is equal to EF minus EI, where F is wherever you end up, and I is wherever you started. So final and initial, if you want to think about it that way. So if you start out in n equals 2 and go to n equals 1, that would be E1 minus E2, right? Can you start in 1 and go to 2? Sure, why not, right? How would you do that? How would you move up? Yeah.
You need energy going in.
Right, you have to add energy, right? Because if you want to go from a lower energy state to a higher one, you have to get that energy from somewhere else. So how would you add that energy into your system? So if you had a photon with an exactly specific energy, the exact specific energy you had to find that difference, and that photon was absorbed by the atom, it would move it up from 1 to 2. Make sense? So how does that help us produce something like an emission or an absorption spectrum, where you have distinct lines? I think you see where I'm going with this, right? David, back to you.
So for emission, when you have electron that drops from, say 2 to say 1, it's going to emit a certain wavelength of light.
Right.
The exact same opposite happens for when you have a photon going through a cloud, it's going to excite, it's going to be a certain type of energy that's going to excite exactly from 1 to 2, and that wavelength will be blocked and will not.
Right. So remember, the energy of a particular orbital state is going to be dependent on whatever its n number is, right? So it's going to only ever be a specific energy. It can't be energy plus a little bit. It has to be that exact specific number. So we can also relate the energy of a photon to its frequency or wavelength by saying, we'll use gamma as a symbol for a photon here. The energy of a photon is equal to the constant h times the frequency. So h is here the Planck constant. Which in SI units is something like 6.626 times 10 to the negative 34 joules per hertz, which is how they specifically define it on Wikipedia. because we're dealing with frequency and that's in units of hertz. You could do just joules times seconds too if you want, but they specifically went out of their way to say joules per hertz, so why not? Because frequency and wavelength are related by the speed of light, you can also say that the energy of a photon is equal to h times the speed of light divided by the wavelength, right? So if you're transitioning between two different levels, right, if you say my delta E between some initial and some final state is equal to some difference here, right, where each of these two levels is defined by an orbital state, you can just say that energy that I need is going to be, can only be given to me, and then is it given or taken away from this atom by a photon with a particular frequency or wavelength, right? So we'll use wavelength as our variable here because I prefer wavelength. So that's how we get an emission spectrum, right? Is that because changes in state can only happen at specific energies, that you get emission at only a specific wavelength, or absorption at that same specific wavelength to move electrons around in an atom. When it comes to photons changing the energy state. So there's lots of different transitions that can happen in a hydrogen atom. It's not just n equals 2 to n equals 1, n equals 3 to n equals 2, right? You can go between any two energy levels. And so when you do that, if you consider all the different transitions you can have, right, you have essentially infinite energy levels in your hydrogen atom. So if you go all the way up to the top, you call that n equals infinity. But down here, we have n equals 1. We'll call that the ground state. So that's the preferred state that the atom wants to be in. If you go from n equals 2 to n equals 1, that's what we call the Lyman alpha line. If you go from n equals 3 to n equals 1, that's the Lyman beta, gamma, delta. That's not a delta. I don't remember what is it? Epsilon is next?
Epsilon.
If you go from n equals whatever to n equals 2, that's what's called the Balmer series. To n equals 3 is the Passion series, then the Bracket series, and it goes on, right? But these are the different series of absorption lines that are sort of useful to us in astronomy because they occur based on their energies at wavelengths that are going to be easily observed, right? So let's think about the Balmer series here, because that's the one that occurs in the optical part of the spectrum. If you go between n equals 2 and n equals 3, or vice versa, the H alpha line is going to be at a wavelength of 656.3 nanometers. Does anybody know what color that is?
Think back to the hydrogen spectrum we looked at in class on Wednesday. Sophia, you weren't here.
So I can still guess, right?
You can still guess.
So it's red?
It's red.
right? So if you remember that spectrum we saw for hydrogen, that bright red line, that's the H alpha line. Because that's right in the middle of the optical part of the spectrum. David.
So when we're measuring energy on this, negative is releasing energy, or?
Yeah, so right, so sorry, negative, right, negative is because we're defining that n equals infinity state to be zero. So as you go closer to the center, you lose energy, so you have to go negative.
Right, so that's like the energy that's releasing the photon.
Yeah. So as you go down, right, you
right.
release energy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So moving down emits energy, moving up absorbs energy. You can think of it that way. If you go between n equals 2 and n equals 4, that's going to be the H beta line, right? We're going alpha, beta, gamma, delta, so on and so forth. So that's this transition right here, right? N equals 2 to n equals 4. That's a bigger gap, which means that it has a bigger energy, right? So what does that mean for the wavelength of the emission or absorption line that we'd see from that transition? It's going to be longer or shorter?
Shorter.
Shorter, right? Because bigger energies have shorter wavelengths. That's coming from this here, right? If you want that number to be bigger, you have to make that number smaller. So what will it be, well, more red or more blue? Blue has shorter wavelength than red, right? So this will be 486.1 nanometers. Still in the optical part of the spectrum, it's that kind of tealish green color that was in the spectrum that we saw on Wednesday. N equals 2 to 5, that's H gamma, that's going to be at 434.0 nanometers. That's that more like dark blue, almost purplish color. 2 to 6. H delta, and that's 410.2. What's happening with the pattern here?
Exponential.
Right. They're getting closer and closer together, basically. So eventually you'll kind of sort of come to a limit, right? What does that limit correspond to? What would happen if I put in a photon that had a shorter wavelength than the limit that we would get to? What would happen to the atom? Talk about it for a minute. Let me rephrase the question. What would happen if I put in a photon that had more energy than you needed to go from n equals whatever to infinity? Right?
Enough to overcome the potential energy.
Garrett, you've been chosen by the deck of cards.
So if you were to give enough energy, it would just knock the electron out of the atom.
Right.
So it would turn the atom into an ion.
Right. So this is what we call ionization. So when you put in more energy than you need to get to n equals infinity, you completely remove that electron from the atom altogether. Can you go the other way? Can a hydrogen atom without an electron capture one back? Yeah, right? Why not? They have opposite charges, they should be attracting to each other. David?
Yeah, and that would take no energy to put in, right? Because they're attracted to each other.
Yeah. Strictly speaking, right?
Yeah.
So if you reabsorbed.
For some reason, my wife always says absorbed, which just. There's an A in there. If you reabsorbed an electron, where would it go?
Ground state? Or the lowest possible.
Would it go to the ground state? Is there any reason it should go to the ground state? It depends on the energy of the electron, right? I guess. Or is it just random?
Depends if the ground state is full.
Yeah,
can't
possible.
Let's assume we just have a proton by itself.
Yeah.
That doesn't have anything in the orbitals.
Yeah,
I'd say it basically would just be random. It would end up somewhere. This is where quantum mechanics comes into play. So what can happen then is that electron can get reabsorbed into n equals 18 or something. And then it can slowly ladder down the atom, emitting lines at given energies until it ends up at the ground state. Things want to be in the ground state, because it's the lowest energy state. But transitioning down spontaneously is, again, a quantum mechanical process. Right, there's going to be probabilities involved. Whether things happen in a given period of time, there's some probability to that, and it doesn't always happen in that period of time. So basically, if you want to think about what that means, is that the best word is brightness of a given line. How easy it is to see that line in an emission spectrum is related to how probable that transition is to occur in an atom. What do you think would be the most common transition to happen in a hydrogen atom? Who knows, right? It sort of depends, right? Just looking at this, you might say, oh, it's n equals 2 to n equals 1, because things are always going to end up there, and that's where one last transition is, you know, going to happen a lot, whereas everything else is going to be a random choice between n equals x and n equals y. I don't know. I went way beyond the scope of this class in that question.
Are photons the only way that you can move electrons around in an atom? David?
Can you do it with heat as well?
With what?
Could you do it with heat as well?
Heat?
Yeah.
That's photons. Or I guess it depends what you mean by heat.
Well, that's just like the average, I guess.
Let's call it collisional, right?
Yeah.
Is that sort of what you mean?
Yeah, that's what I mean.
So you can do something called collisional excitation. Or you can also do collisional de-excitation too. What other particle is involved in a collisional transition? Garrett?
Like another electron that's going to
Yeah, an electron, maybe you bump into another proton or something for some reason, but that's unlikely to happen because of the Coulomb barrier. In some conditions, it's a lot more likely to happen, and we'll talk about that when we talk about nuclear fusion. You bump an electron in, and the energy of that electron can change where the electrons inside go too. In both ways. You can also do collisional ionization too, or if you really smack one in. That's going to be dependent on kinetic energy to determine what happens. That process is part of the first book problem from homework 2. So there's some practice there. Remember that kinetic energy is 1/2 mv squared for that part. So what this means basically is that it's not just hydrogen that does this, right? It's every atom has a set of states that its electron can be in. Yeah, question? Yes. Photons are released in collisional de-excitation, but not necessarily in collisional excitation, if that makes sense, right? Because you're absorbing kinetic energy from an electron. You don't necessarily have to have a photon in that case. But if you knock something down, a photon has to come out. I guess it could also go into the electron too and speed it up, but I think usually you get a photon. Does that answer your question? Good. So every atom has some set of electron orbital states that electrons can live in. Bigger atoms, more complex atoms, obviously have more of those, right? But, you know, infinity. What does it mean to really have more? So I'll show you what a typical... Here is the absorption spectrum of a star. Just a quick shot in the dark. Does anybody know which star this is?
The sun.
This is our own star's absorption spectrum. So what are the features that we particularly notice here? Garrett?
It's like almost all the colors are visible, but there's regions where there's no color visible. That's like where it's absorbing.
Right. So what kind of spectrum is this? An absorption spectrum, right? So what is the background rainbow coming from then? That's what we would call a continuous spectrum, right? That's equal to the rainbow in the background. What you'll see here, basically, this goes from long wavelength at the top down to short at the bottom. So this like dark, almost brown, that's gonna get into the infrared part of the spectrum. This is getting into the ultraviolet part. And then visible in between. Do you see a lot of lines here?
Yes.
Yes, right? Zoom in a bit. Are there any particular trends you notice where the lines are?
There's a lot more absorption lines at higher energies.
is a lot more absorption lines at higher energies, meaning shorter wavelengths, right? There's a lot more going on down here in the green and the blue than there is up here in the red and the orange. That's interesting. Why is that, do you suppose? That's a rhetorical question for now. Any particular ones you can pick out? Like, label with what element they are? There are three that you should know at this point.
There's a big gap in, like, the red segment. I'm assuming that's hydrogen.
This one?
Yeah.
Yep, that's H-alpha. One here?
Yeah.
That's H beta. Well done. And then H gamma is, I think it's this one. I'm not sure though. This is not labeled with wavelengths, so that might be wrong. So I'll put a question mark next to it. Anything else? Doubt it, right? We haven't talked about any other ones. So what on earth could all these other lines be from? There's lots of elements. The only one I remember off the top of my head is these two. That's a sodium pair. So we at least know we have sodium in the sun. That's good to know. Salt is so good. Love it. A lot of these are iron lines. We'll use iron as sort of a tracer of composition in stars as we talk about what the different types of stars are. David.
So this tells what the sun is actually made out of, right? But also,
yeah.
Does it also track what's in between the sun and the Earth?
Strictly speaking, yes, but that material is so low in density that it basically doesn't contribute much at all. Steve?
Is iron the final fusion product in the life cycle of a star?
In stars above 8 solar masses, yes.
Okay.
In stars less than 8 solar masses, it depends how massive you are.
Super.
But generally, it's going to be carbon or oxygen. Garrett? They're probably, I don't know specifically about this spectrum, but I would assume that it is, there are some of these lines are atmospheric lines, yes. Not many of them. The stuff in the atmosphere that really contributes a lot is water vapor. And those are going to be like big gouges out in the infrared part.
So like, are the dark lines in this the same as the lines we saw? The dark ones on this are the ones we saw when we were looking through the thing?
Yes.
Okay.
But the other way around, right? They're absorption lines, not emission lines.
Okay, so then like the places where there's not as many gaps cut out is what the sun would look more like, since that's what it's emitting? Or what?
So this is a good question. So this is where sort of where I want to go next, right? So what wavelengths is the sun emitting? Talk about that for a second. We'll turn it back on you. Which wavelengths does the sun emit photons at? That's a terribly constructed sentence, but I don't get the idea, right?
Well, it's going to be like the overall color. It's a kind of graphic of everything that isn't black. The reason it has that
picture is
Thinking about it. Mark.
So it'll admit anything that isn't a black line.
Okay.
So mostly like orange and yellow.
Okay. Anything that's not a black line. Do you all agree? Garrett's shaking his head no. Why not, Garrett? I'm going to give you a little bit of credit, Mark, because you're not totally wrong, right? So it depends on how you define emit, first of all, right? This is what we see on Earth, right? So if you want to think about it that way, this you see what you get, right? So it defines where you it depends where you define the boundary of where you're emitting from. So you're not totally wrong, right? But let's think, this is an absorption spectrum, right? So what does it mean to be an absorption spectrum? Let's go back to our definition. A cool diffuse gas in front of a continuous spectrum produces dark spectral lines. So what wavelengths does the sun produce? Continuous spectrum, right? It produces all wavelengths.
Right.
So what's with the gaps then? Sophia?
I guess everything produces all wavelengths, so this is just like, so saying that isn't super meaningful in this case because these are the ones that are way more common and that actually have like a and because there's only discrete energy transitions that are allowed, you can't have like continuous energy.
Let's think back to our definition again one more time.
So like the sun is emitting like all wavelengths in a continuous spectrum, but then like the various like elements and stuff within the sun are like absorbing some of that.
Yep. So we have a cool diffuse gas in front of a continuous spectrum. Right? So that means that in the structure of our sun, right, this is the sun, right? So it's not anything in between or our atmosphere, it's plus or minus a few. This is what the sun looks like from far away. That means in the structure of the sun, part of it is going to be cooler than the rest of it. Right? Does that make sense to everybody? So think about the Earth, right? The Earth has the rocky part, and then it has an atmosphere. Now, if you could imagine that the rocky part, right, it's hot in the middle and cold on the outside, and then the atmosphere sits on top, right? The sun has a similar structure, where it's hot in the middle and cold at the top. And so the stuff at the top is what's producing the absorption lines, the cool stuff at the top. But underneath that, you're producing photons of every wavelength. Does that make sense? So you have a continuous source inside covered by a candy shell of absorption spectrum. David. So we'll talk about the sun, I think, next week, later next week or week after, next 2 weeks sometime. But basically what we'll say is that when we define the surface of the sun, where the light comes from, that's called the photosphere. And then on top of the photosphere is a cool layer of gas that absorbs. Yeah. Mark.
So going back to the question.
Yeah, so this is why I said it was a more esoteric question than I initially thought, right? Because the sun is producing photons of all wavelengths. But what comes out is with gaps in it for the absorption lines from the different elements in the atmosphere of the sun are. Does that make sense? Does that help answer the question to you? Okay. Let me draw a diagram.
Think of it that all of the light that we see from the sun is being produced at the core where all the fusion is happening.
Right.
That's like 15 million Kelvin. And as it travels outward from the core, it eventually reaches the photosphere, which is like three orders of magnitude cooler. It's only about 6,000 Kelvin.
Yeah.
So the top layer of the sun is the diffuse gas where the absorption lines are being produced.
Right.
The core is the hot, dense object where the continuous spectrum is being produced.
Garrett.
So is it in like, can you think of like the photosphere as like a filter for the things that were for the...
Exactly, right? I guess it's warm in here. Right, so think about it, right. So if you think about it, like if I'm standing here with a flashlight, right, and pointing it at you, and I put a color filter in front of it, I'm making all the different colors, but you're only seeing red or blue, right? So what's producing the lines is the filter in between us and the source. That's a great way of thinking about it. Yeah. Does that help, Mark?
Mm-hmm.
Good. Come on.
So like if you were like defining the sun as just the core, then it would be the full rainbow. But if you're defining the sun as like the entire thing, then would it be with like it emit everything except for the black lines then?
Say it one more time.
So like if you were saying the sun is just the core, like mm-hmm. that's what's emitting, then it'd be the rainbow, but if you're defining the sun as like the actual entire sun, then it would be minus the black lines.
Yes.
Okay.
I think I understand.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
yeah, in front.
If the core of the star emits at all wavelengths, then how do you look at a black body to determine what elements compose a star?
Haha. It's the lines, though. That's what tells you the elements. So right, so we're getting ahead of ourselves by a few weeks here, but basically, when we talk about the composition of a star, we can only really measure what's on the outer layer that produces the spectrum. So what's inside could be totally different. And it often is, right? So if you think about the structure of a star, you have sort of onion layers, where you have the top is hydrogen, and then you have helium and carbon and oxygen sort of going down in layers. That's not reflected in what we see in proportion to what the different amounts of the elements are. What we see is basically a trace of the gas that the star formed from, whatever the initial composition of the star was, and that's changing over time as the star fuses. But we'll come to that later. You had a question too, right? That was okay. Cool. So how do we get the continuous spectrum? It's formed by fusion, essentially. It's a little more complicated than that, but we'll talk about that when we talk about how we get the photons out later. Things that are as hot as the core of the sun don't come out at these wavelengths. They have to take a long time to, they're really high energy photons, right? So, but how do we characterize the continuous spectrum? Let's talk about that. So you use the phrase black body. What does that mean? Let's talk about it. So, let's define the phrase ideal emitter first. An ideal emitter absorbs all the light that is incident upon it. Then re-radiates the same amount of energy in a characteristic spectrum. So that's a super general definition, right? So you could basically say, you could construct some theoretical ideal emitter where you have like solar panels or something that are powering an LED, and you shine flashlights at the solar panels, and the amount of energy you put in with the flashlights comes out in the LED, right? You can think up a theoretical system that does this. So this doesn't necessarily apply to, it does apply to the sun and other stars, but and black bodies, but it doesn't, it's a square rectangle type thing, right? All black bodies are ideal emitters, but not all ideal emitters are black bodies. For a black body, the characteristic spectrum that we're talking about is what we call the black body spectrum. Okay? We call it a black body. This is a really confusing terminology, right? We call it a black body because of the absorbing part. Because if you're shining light on a black body at all wavelengths, it's absorbing all the light, so it would look black if it weren't re-emitting. Does that make sense? So if you imagine like looking back that piece of black fabric in the corner, right, that's absorbing light at all the wavelengths we're shooting at it, and it's re-emitting light in a black body spectrum, but it's cool enough that it's not coming out in visible light. Does it make sense? On the fly example. So what does a black body spectrum look like? Sophia, sorry.
You said all black bodies are ideal emitters, but not all ideal emitters are black bodies. Mm-hmm. Did you say what the difference was here?
It's just that you can create a theoretical system, a contrived system that absorbs all energy and re-emits it at a specific wavelength, for example, right? Like if I had a red LED connected to some batteries and I charged the batteries, that sort of thing.
So if I just ask what's the difference between an ideal emitter and a black body, what's the answer to that?
There is no difference.
Okay.
All squares are rectangles, but not all rectangles are squares.
Yeah, so I want to know why not all ideal emitters are black bodies. What is more special about a black body?
That it's the shape of the spectrum that it emits.
Okay.
Is a specific shape, which I'm about to describe.
Once it has a specific spectrum, then it's a black body.
Yes.
Okay.
If it emits at this particular, if in this particular characteristic spectrum, it is a black body. If it does not, it's not.
Got it.
Okay. Any other questions? I thought I saw someone else's hand. So what does a black body spectrum look like? Here are some examples. So what we have here is a graph of three different black body spectra at three different temperatures, 8,000 Kelvin, 6,000 Kelvin, and 4,000 Kelvin. Along the x-axis, we have wavelength in angstroms for arbitrary reasons. And then along the y-axis, this is intensity at a given wavelength. So how bright that black body is at that given wavelength, and units of watts per square meter per steradian per angstrom. Why did we do it that way? That's a good question. Do I have what graph that's supposed to be? Yeah. Basically, if you think about how something emits light, you have a patch. Imagine this is the sort of this grayish background is the sun, and you're measuring how much you have coming out of this, how much light you have coming out of the sun in a given, say, square meter patch that has an area delta A. And it comes out at some angle, theta, and in a solid angle, d omega, that's your steradians part. And then you have light coming out at different wavelengths, that's the per angstrom part, right? So we don't want to get into that. That's a stellar physics question. Astronomy 311, so there's lots of integrals involved. I think they run through some of it in the book if you want to see how they do it, but not today. So basically, right, so this is how bright it is at a given wavelength. You can ignore the steradians part and square meters part, so you measure watts per angstrom, basically. What do we notice here are the differences between these three different black body curves? Well, what's the first of the overall general shape, right? Is you have at short wavelengths, it's basically zero. And then it has some peak at a longer wavelength, and then it decays down as you go to longer and longer wavelengths. So it has this characteristic peak shape. What do we notice about the different temperatures here? What different things are we seeing as we change temperature? David?
Intensity of increases as the temperature increases.
Increases what?
Between the lines.
Yeah. So the higher your temperature, the higher up you go in intensity at any wavelength, right? Anything else, Sophia?
The higher the temperature, the sharper the peak.
The higher the temperature, the sharper the peak.
So
I would say, yeah, so that's sort of, yeah, that's more or less the same thing as David said, but slightly in a slightly different way, right? So you're saying more really that it's not that you're higher at a given wavelength, it's that the peak itself gets even higher.
That it's sharper. I mean, you could have
right.
You could have that 800 Kelvin. You could just have that way tinier.
It's
but
more.
It wouldn't do that because if it were tinier, it would be at a lower temperature and it would be more broad.
Right.
So I think it's different.
Right. Lots of hands. Sean.
Hotter things would probably be more blue than red.
Hotter things would be more blue than red. Why do you say that? Hotter things are brighter at shorter wavelengths, but they're also brighter at longer wavelengths, too. Aren't they?
Like relatively.
Relatively. The ratio of the peak to the, what we call the long tail, is different, right? So this difference is smaller than this difference. What about where the peak occurs? David, did you?
Yeah, this is as temperature goes up, the wavelength gets smaller.
Right, so if you sort of, right, the peak is here, here, and here-ish, right? So the hotter you get, the bluer your peak is. So that's sort of built into what Sean was saying too. So how do we quantify that stuff? No, Steve, did you wanna?
I had a question on, as the limit of wavelength approaches infinity, do they, regardless of temperature, do all approach the same intensity?
I think, strictly speaking, yes. They would all go. They would all approach zero at infinity.
Okay.
But they won't quite get there. I think that's a fair enough way to say that. We're dealing with infinity, but at a very high number, the 8,000 Kelvin one will still be higher up than the 6,000 Kelvin one, but they'll still be approaching zero. Does that make sense? But, you know, at infinity, technically. So, how do we quantify some of the stuff we've talked about? So let's start with the peak, or the position of the peak one. This is something called Wien's law. And basically it says that the wavelength of the maximum intensity, so the wavelength where the intensity is the highest, or lambda max, is equal to 0.0029 meters times Kelvin divided by temperature. That's pretty straightforward inverse relationship, right? As you make temperature go up, your wavelength has to get smaller. By that constant, 0.0029. Easy, right? The other thing that we can quantify here is the area underneath the curve, so essentially integrating over all wavelengths. And also integrating over the square meters and steradians part. So this would be, if you did that integral, you'd end up with this. We'll call that the luminosity. So that'll be L is equal to the surface area of the object, A, times sigma T to the fourth power. Where sigma here is the Stefan-Boltzmann constant. Which is 5.67 times 10 to the negative 8 watts per square meter per Kelvin to the fourth. Kelvin to the negative fourth. So that, you know, you can see the units coming out there. So luminosity is basically going to be in watts as your answer. So there's your meter squared and there's your Kelvin. So if I had two objects of the same surface area, the brighter one, when I mean brighter, I mean higher luminosity, will be the one with the higher temperature. Sophia.
So intensity is like photons per area, right? not the y-axis there, but intensity in general, is, oh, photons per area per time, or just photons per area?
This one gets a little confusing because there's lots of different ways you can write it down. But when we talk about intensity, we're going to mean specifically watts per square meter per steradian per angstrom.
Yeah, I just meant in general. Also, that wasn't my question. My question was, if that's the case or if not, is luminosity like total photons? Or can you say luminosity in a physical way and use photons?
Yeah, so luminosity is the total energy output of the black body per unit time.
Okay.
So watt is a joule per second, right? That's what it is.
So you can say, since it's energy per time, you can say it's photons per time, right?
Yeah. More or less, yes. But each photon will have a different energy, which is where in the intensity, the per angstrom part is. Sean?
Are luminosity and brightness the same thing, but intensity is something different?
So, right, so brightness is something different. Yeah, so there's intensity, which is on a particular patch of star, so in a watts per square meter, in a given direction, steradians, at a particular wavelength. Brightness is how many photons come out of the star that you can measure at a given distance away. So it's watts per square meter. We'll talk about that one in a minute, or Monday, because a minute is about how much time we have left. And luminosity is the total energy output of the black body per unit time. So integrated over all these quantities, per square meter, per steradian, per wavelength. If you take each photon that comes out, find out how much energy it has, and add it all up, you get the luminosity. Does that make sense? So, how do we know what the shape of this curve is? So this takes a form of something called the Planck equation. So we'll say that we'll use the letter capital B, B of lambda, as a function of temperature, right? So basically we're saying we're going to write down an equation that at a given wavelength you have a certain intensity come out, but that's defined by the temperature of the object, which each object can only have one temperature. So that's why you have three different curves here, is that these each, you put 4,000 Kelvin in, you'd get a certain curve. If you put 6,000 in, you'd get a different one. But you still have things at all wavelengths. B lambda of t is equal to 2hc squared over lambda to the fifth divided by e to the hc over k lambda kt. Sorry. Minus 1. Yes, this is like that.
I guess K is the Boltzmann constant?
Yes, K is the Boltzmann constant, H is the Planck constant, and C is the speed of light.
And what's B?
B is just, it's intensity, basically. So if we would, on this is B. They just call it I here for some reason. So H is the Planck constant. K is Boltzmann. C is the speed of light. So, right, basically what that means is that the only two variables in here are T and lambda, right? So if you pick a single temperature, then the only thing that's left is wavelength that can change, right? And so if you pick a temperature and plot lambda versus B, you get something that looks like the above graph. So if you wanted to find something like luminosity from this, you could do that by saying luminosity at a given wavelength d lambda is equal to b lambda t d lambda d area times cosine theta d omega. We're not going to do that, right? But this is where you get the angstroms, meters squared, and steradians in that other graph. So integrating these all up, integrate over the wavelengths, integrate over the area that you're emitting over, integrate over the angle you're pointing, and then integrate over the solid angle you're doing the emission at, gives you the luminosity. Any questions? So that's black bodies, right? So the sun has a temperature of about 6,000 Kelvin, right? So you could plot out what the sun's continuous spectrum should look like. It should be this solid line. But we don't see that in the sun, right? We see the solid line with little chunks taken out at all the absorption lines that the elements in the atmosphere are absorbing out of the sun's continuous spectrum. Okay, we'll leave it there for today. Wednesday, don't forget, bring your computer. We're gonna do Python. If you don't wanna come, you don't have to, you know, that's fine too, but David?
Is there a particular program we should download before, or?
I would recommend, if you wanna get your computer set up ahead of time, is go on and download the latest version of Anaconda.
Anaconda.
Yeah. There's a link to that on the webpage under the Python section. Garrett?
Is there a list of like what you're covering in terms of Python?
Basic stuff. Just enough to get you started.